You're listening to a free show on WrestlingObserver.com, the leaders in news and inside information on both professional wrestling and mixed martial arts. To learn how to subscribe and get immediate access to hundreds of past newsletters written by Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez, as well as thousands of hours of podcasts and interviews, go to bit.ly/JNPO subscribe. That's bit.ly/JNPO subscribe. Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 38 of Josh Nason's Punch Out. I am Josh Nason, assistant web editor for WrestlingObserver.com, formerly of Bloody Elbow, Fight Magazine, Bleacher Report, and some other great websites across the internet. Thank you all for joining me this week. On tap, really fun conversation. No MMA coming up this weekend, other than Bellator, but no like real major events. So I want to take the time to talk a little bit about a book and a little bit about MMA as well with Chad Dundas. Chad writes for Bleacher Report, but he is also the author of a book that's going to be released this summer, a novel called Champion of the World, which has to do with pro wrestling back in the olden era. So I think if you guys are into pro wrestling literature, which there isn't a lot of, and that's one of the reasons Chad wrote this book, I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. We also talked a lot about the news that Michael Bisping is getting the title shot, the middleweight title shot against Luke Rockhold coming up. We talked about some leftover thoughts of UFC 198, which happened this past weekend, a little bit on Cyborg Santos, Fabricio Werdum's ugly, bizarre, strange face and how often he kept making it, and some other news and notes as well. Note that this interview was recorded on Wednesday afternoon, so some of the other news that kind of broke on Wednesday night we didn't get to. However, I will get to that after the interview. So without further ado, let's get to Chad Dundas of Bleacher Report and his upcoming book, Champion of the World. So we do get a break from UFC action this weekend, but that doesn't mean we don't have anything to talk about. Our guest this week is a lead MMA writer for Bleacher Report, one half of the world-famous and awesomely named co-main event podcast with Ben Folks, and also the author of a soon-to-be-published, when Champion of the World hits bookshelves and Kindles worldwide. We head to Montana for the very first time on the show and welcome the man who puts the man in Bozeman, Chad Dundas. We welcome him to Josh Nason's Punch Out. And Chad, you know, we like to start out with the hard questions first, so I hope you're ready. What do Dancing with the Tiger, The Sunlight Pilgrims, Julian Fellowes' Belgravia, and The Muse have in common?
That is a hard question. I'm going to go with three things I've never heard of.
That's close. Well, technically, you're right, because if you haven't heard of them, I can't say to you, you have. So you're right on that. So well played. So what they are is when you look for your book on Amazon, they come up in the little strip underneath saying, there's other titles the people have searched for this book, search for.
That's actually interesting news. Like when I search for my own book, it always says that like people have also searched for products like boxing hand wraps and, stuff to clean the mats at their jiu-jitsu gym. So it's good to know that people are searching for my book and also searching for other books.
Yeah. I think it'd be interesting a list that people can have when they're writing these books and putting them out there. What items would like people you like most to associate with your book? So, I mean, are there other things that people, you know, if they're shopping, because people can get anything on Amazon these days, from like Cheez-Its to diapers to everything in between. Is there anything in specific that when people are looking for a book, you'd love to see underneath other items?
Well, I mean, if you're going to completely enjoy Champion of the World, which is out in bookstores everywhere on July 12th, by the way, you're probably going to need a good pair of wrestling shoes. You're probably going to need a workable singlet, and you're probably going to need a stiff shot of whiskey.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of my favorite things in there. That's great. That's great. We're going to talk about the book in a few seconds here, but again, we have a lot of different kind of news bits. It's kind of like a slower news week, which is good. I think we're going to get hit a lot here over the next few weeks, and obviously leading into 200 with a lot of news. But today, as we record this on a beautiful Wednesday afternoon, Michael Bisping has had a beautiful Wednesday afternoon. He is going to be taking on Luke Rockhold, his first ever title shot in the UFC. And kind of interesting when all this news broke that Chris Weidman was going to be out, and we'll talk about that in a second. But when you first heard about Michael Bisping getting the shot, what'd you think?
I can live with Michael Bisping getting a shot at the UFC middleweight title for sure. I think that, you know, it might actually be kind of a feel good moment for Michael Bisping. He's a guy that throughout his time in the UFC, I think has had a real personal like transformation just in terms of how he's viewed by fans. You know, he was one of the first guys in the modern era, along with guys like Josh Koscheck, to really embrace the heel role, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, he did it so naturally and completely and at a time when most guys were still valuing sportsmanship so much that it took a lot of people a long time to warm up to that. And for a long time, I think Bisping was viewed as a real villain, especially outside of his native England. But I think at this point, he's been in the UFC so long. He's a real veteran. I think that almost everybody pretty much respects the guy and have, you know, if not out and out, positive feelings for him. I think that he's earned a grudging respect from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And frankly was probably a better fighter than a lot of people gave him credit for throughout the bulk of his career. So, to have a guy like that get a UFC title shot, I think even though a lot of people probably aren't expecting him to go out there and beat Luke Rockhold, I think it's the kind of thing that you can't get too mad about, because up until this point, Bisping was regarded as one of the best fighters in UFC history to have never fought for a UFC title. So to see him get that opportunity, I think is fine by me. You know, a lot of people probably wanted to see Gegard Mousasi or Jacare Souza get the nod, but you know, Michael Bisping versus Luke Rockhold hits my ear just fine.
Yeah. I think with, you know, you look at like the options that were out there, and granted, we found out that Souza has a torn meniscus and is going to have to get surgery. Mousasi was honestly never on my radar for a title shot. I think with, you know, they're trying to keep this momentum going throughout the, you know, the first half of the year leading into 200. These fights with, I guess, for lack of a better word, for fights with people that with guys that people know, you know, sure. The casual MMA fans, you and I, and people listening to this probably know who all these guys are. But I think for, you know, that kind of recognizance and be like, okay, cool. There's a story here. Michael Bisping is finally getting a shot at the UFC, at a UFC title. We remember, you know, for people that may have fallen off, they may remember him obviously from, as you mentioned, some of his more villainous times in the UFC and when he was really kind of playing up that heel role. So again, I'm fine with it. I think, you know, from a competitive standpoint, he's got his work cut out for him on 3 weeks' notice, but stranger things have happened. And I mean, I'm fine with it, because it was funny. Like I saw like Uriah Hall basically insinuating that Luke was like ducking him or something like that, which I thought was kind of odd because he wasn't on my radar at all. I think it's a perfectly fine fight and exactly what they wanted. Someone that can slot in, that people know, that's not going to necessarily make people think, oh wow, this is the main event. It's kind of weird. It's a nice kind of like story, and I think it's going to be just fine once people kind of get over their initial misgivings about Bisping. But overall, I think it's great.
Yeah, and probably a little bit tinged with depression at having Chris Weidman out and not getting to see Weidman and Rockhold rematch, at least at this point. Yeah. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, you know, when I was talking about earlier, Bisping kind of embracing the heel role, like one of the things that he did to his own benefit and to really great effect, I think, is fashion himself into the kind of guy who can promote an interesting fight with almost anyone. He's done it over and over again, and a lot of times has done it by, you know, manufacturing some very personal beef with whoever his opponent is going to be. But I think on 3 weeks' notice against Luke Rockhold, like you said, you want a recognizable face out there and you want a guy like Michael Bisping that is going to be able to handle the media obligations and turn it into as much of a positive as you can, given that you didn't have a lot of notice to book the fight. And I think that if Michael Bisping was ever going to get a UFC middleweight title shot, like this is a great time to do it. He comes in on a little win streak. He comes in on the heels of beating Anderson Silva, albeit a reduced version of Anderson Silva for sure. So just the stars sort of aligned for him in this case, I guess.
Does Chris Weidman officially become tagged with injury prone?
Oh boy. I hope not. I mean, Chris Weidman has a lot of his own things to worry about in terms of, being a high-level 185-pound fighter, but being a guy that just doesn't seem like he's ever really been embraced by the pay-per-view buying public or embraced by a large portion of UFC fans, some of whom I think are probably still angry with him for beating Anderson Silva two times in a row. But he's a guy that previous to losing to the title to Luke Rockhold seemed like the prototype for the future of 185 pound fighters, and seemed like a guy with all the talent in the world and all the upside in the world. So it would be a shame to see a career like that kind of get sidetracked by injuries, like some of the careers we've seen in mixed martial arts before. So hopefully it doesn't become a serious, serious habit for Chris Weidman to be injured, but I hear you.
Yeah. We've on this show before we talked about kind of Weidman and how it's just this weird thing. And I think that the Silva thing, I think beating a legend like that, I think people automatically feel like there's just, no matter what, they're going to feel like there's an asterisk on it because it wasn't supposed to happen the way it happened, all the weirdness, whatever. But even in Weidman's statement that he made on Facebook a little while ago, just basically kind of really going over the injuries and almost like trying to justify how he got hurt and why he got hurt. And he said, all the people bad mouthing me right now, I understand it. You can tell your opinion, blah, blah, blah. It's like, to me, like, he doesn't have to explain himself, but I guess maybe in this era and maybe just the way he is, he feels like, as a pro athlete and a fighter that's expected this kind of antiquated notion of, oh, you got to fight no matter what. Maybe that's kind of what he has to do, but almost, it feels like he's almost pandering a little bit, or just, I don't know. It's just a weird thing with him. There's so many people that like him, but there's so many people that just, for some reason, he just hasn't scratched that itch. It's a weird thing. I can't get it.
Yeah. He's one of those guys that there's not necessarily anything wrong with him. But at the same time, it seems like he kind of is one of these guys who perennially, like, not necessarily sticks his foot in his mouth, but, like, just makes it kind of weird whenever he gets the opportunity to like, make a statement or be on camera, get interviewed, anything like that. I remember I can't remember which fight it was after, but one of his recent title defenses where he implored everyone to get on the team.
The Weidman wagon, something like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it was just like, implied that if we didn't get on board with him, he was going to leave us behind or something like that. And it was just the way that he pitched it on the mic during his post-fight interview was just, not necessarily bad, but at the same time, like, just kind of weird. And he's a hard guy to kind of get nailed down in that regard.
Yeah, he's a interesting case, Chris Weidman. So we'll see, obviously, what happens with him next. But that, I mean, really news-wise, it's been pretty quiet. Was there any kind of leftover thoughts from this past weekend's UFC 198 for you? What was kind of your was Stipe's win the heavyweight title? Was that really kind of the big story for you heading out? Or is there anything that came out of that was more interesting to you?
Well, I think there were a couple of things, and one of them was Stipe Miocic winning the heavyweight title, which still, I saw some people talking about it on Twitter, and I agree with them that it doesn't even quite feel real right now that Stipe Miocic is the UFC heavyweight champion, just because Fabricio Werdum had the title for so long without defending it. We kind of got used to this idea of him as the champion, and he obviously came into this fight in his native Brazil as a slight favorite, according to the odds, I don't want to say anyone overlooked Stipe Miocic here, because clearly we know that he's a good heavyweight fighter and a good striker and a capable guy. But things were kind of laying out in Werdum's favor, I think you could say, in so far as there can ever be a clear heavyweight title picture in the UFC, because we thought he, if he gets through this one, then he maybe has a third fight with Alistair Overeem, and then if he were to get through that one, potentially a rematch with either Cain Velasquez or Travis Brown, depending on who wins their fight at UFC 200. And you know, those are two guys that Verdum has pretty recently defeated. So just in terms of like the instability at the top of the UFC heavyweight division and the UFC heavyweight title kind of perennially never being able to get out of its own way, we looked at Verdum and thought, huh, maybe this is the guy. Maybe he can put together a nice little win streak here. And then, of course, he goes out there, gets knocked out in the first round by Stipe Miocic. And now you have this kind of transference of feelings from Verdum to Stipe, where, you know, just in the spectrum of the UFC heavyweight division, like, he's a fairly young guy. He's pretty athletic. He's big enough that he can compete with the heavyweights, and also athletic and quick enough that he can outquick a lot of the more hulking heavyweights. And now you look at him and you think, how long is this one going to last? Maybe this is the guy who can put together a couple of title defenses. So it's just the perennial instability of the UFC heavyweight division. So it might take us a little while to wrap our minds around Cleveland's own heavyweight champion, Stipe Miocic.
I think when it comes to heavyweight champions, both in, you know, boxing, MMA, I think people don't really know, still don't know yet, what do they want? Do they want the guy that looks the part like the heavyweight champion? A guy's just Jack to the gills, a massive guy, one that, you know, like the mountain from Game of Thrones or something like that? Or do they want someone like, say, like a Stipe, who, you know, he's like you mentioned, he's great shape, you know, hits obviously hard, has skills, speaks well, seems like a great guy, all this stuff. Is this the type of person? Do we want the all-around skilled guy like Fabricio, didn't necessarily hit? Do we want kind of the Cain Velasquez type, the guy that kind of the quiet man type, but just comes through, and when he gets in the cage is just a tornado when he's absolutely healthy? Do you want the Brock Lesnar types? It seems that, you know, with heavyweight especially, people don't really know. I think people, what they like or what they perceive a heavyweight champion to look like, to me, seems to dictate whether or not they fully buy them as champions. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly you had Brock Lesnar come along and garnered a ton of mainstream media attention just based on physical appearance alone, almost. And also, you know, his WWE history and also as an NCAA national champ. I actually wrote a thing on Bleacher Report this past week about Miocic, just saying, like, if you need a champion in this like topsy-turvy heavyweight division that never seems to be able to you know, find any stability, yeah, you could do a lot worse than having a guy like Stipe Miocic. He's a guy who doesn't seem to take himself too seriously. He's an entertaining social media follow. He's a guy who seems affable and you know, as a working firefighter there outside of Cleveland in the Cleveland area, I think he's a guy that you could promote if you really wanted to. And then on top of that, he's a pretty good and exciting fighter too. So I think that there's some reason to be cautiously optimistic about him. Although I would say that, you know, we've certainly learned our lesson in the past about being optimistic about heavyweight fighters, and who knows how long the title run will last for him. The other thing that stuck out to me from UFC 198 was, the debut of Cyborg Justino, which was a long time coming, and, mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of a potential watershed moment for the future of women's MMA, and was kind of a feel good moment to see her finally make her UFC debut, especially in her hometown in front of so many fans. And then of course she goes out there and blitzes Leslie Smith. You got a little bit of an early stoppage in that fight, but at the same time, like, a successful debut for Cyborg. And then she gets on the mic and kind of downplays it a little bit, downplays her future in the UFC, where they still don't really have a natural weight class for her to fight. Says she's intent on going back to Invicta FC to defend her women's featherweight title. So didn't really make it into the big historical moment that maybe it could have been had she been a little bit more willing to call out Ronda Rousey or call out Miesha Tate or Holly Holm or whoever. But I mean, it might be a situation where Cyborg Justina was kind of sticking to her guns on the weight issue. And I don't know, man, I think you kind of got to respect her for that, as you move forward, even if it is going to cost her probably a lot of money and possibly sets up as kind of anticlimactic in the UFC moving forward.
After, Cyborg put on that beatdown, which a lot of people expect, and like you allude to, it felt like an early stoppage and what have you. But I think it felt like the outcome, no matter what, wasn't going to be in doubt, just based on past experience and based on what we had seen in there for those few minutes. What I came away with is, and I'm surprised this week, I thought that we were going to see Cyborg pushed a lot more in mainstream media. And why I say that is, This whole Ronda thing, people are just don't seem to be convinced, or people are convinced she's coming back, but in a lot of ways, a lot of people are like, what's taking so long? Like, we haven't really heard much, and we know it's kind of Ronda's way, but there's also this kind of this creeping doubt that, will she ever come back? And if she does, is it just going to be one fight, and then she's going to bounce and say, I'm good? And to me, I think the UFC now that we're in is always going to have a strong female lead. It feels like no matter what, they want to have someone that they can kind of hang their hat on to say, look, we have this fantastic men's champions here, but we also have this awesome women's champion here. And it could be Joanna Jędrzejczyk. Over time, we'll see. But I think Cyborg is that one that also kind of attracts the male audience, of that she just is this powerhouse, this beast that just keeps, knocking people out. Impressive stuff. And I thought this was kind of a nice transition to think, all right, well, if Ronda's not coming back, who are we going to really push? And it's going to be Cyborg. Granted, yeah, she doesn't have a weight class, but I think that no matter what, they're going to maybe try to make it financially worth it for somebody to fight her twice a year, get that kind of buzz out of it and say, belts be damned. This is our lady. This is our woman to get behind. But I've heard basically like nothing about her this week. I was really, and I know English isn't her first language, but I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, it's an interesting turn of events, like kind of an interesting plot twist, just because she and the UFC have had such an on again, off again, and at sometimes kind of bitter relationship. It's been sort of ugly here and there, and it's been such a protracted effort to actually get her into the UFC and get her a fight that it felt like that they had turned the corner when they booked this catchweight fight, because certainly it was a matchup that felt like it was set up to make Cyborg look good. I mean, you're going to have it at 140 pounds and you book her against Leslie Smith, who previous to coming to the UFC herself had fought in the Invicta flyweight division. So had fought at 125 pounds. And she's going to come up essentially a weight class and a half from maybe her natural weight class to meet Cyborg at 140 pounds. And Cyborg is going to come down from 145. It just felt like a matchup that was contrived to make Cyborg look good. So I'm right there with you. I expected a bigger push. I expected more plans. I expected her to get on the mic and do something a little bit more bombastic with her time. But maybe at the end of the day, it's a situation where she tried to cut down as much as she could poundage wise. She got down to 139 for this fight. Maybe that experience kind of redoubled her determination that she can't really safely make 135 pounds. So maybe, everybody's in kind of wait and see mode here, because you'd think that somebody like Holly Holm or Miesha Tate or Ronda would go up to fight her at 140 for the fight purse alone, if nothing else. But it could just be that we're in a holding pattern here to see what can happen next for her, just because she is kind of a tweener.
My other big takeaway from UFC 198 was I hope we finally seen the end to some extent of the Verdum face, one he kept doing time and time and time again on the way to the cage, before the fight, in the cage. It was like, dude, it felt like a celebration for him winning the UFC heavyweight title to begin with. It didn't feel like he was fully there. I don't know. Physically, he looked a little bit different. It just felt like he wasn't really going in there focused on, I'm going to beat this guy and retain my belt, as much as, almost like a bullfighter who had bested a bull, you know, going and getting roses thrown from the crowd. He just seemed to be really enjoying himself too much and didn't seem focused on the opponent in hand. And the face just, the face was kind of like, dude, we get it. We get it. We get it. We get it. And then he just got blitzed. I don't know. I just, did you feel like he wasn't as serious as he could be, or am I just taking it a little bit too seriously based on the facial, so to speak?
I am on record coming out as against the Fabricio Werdum troll face. I've gone back and forth with Ben Folks, my podcast co-host on the Co-Main Event podcast, about it. It kind of felt from Werdum like he got some initial chuckles from the face and then was like, okay, well, this is just going to be my thing while I'm heavyweight champion. Like, this is the thing I will do to make myself marketable, is that I will just make this face over and over and over again. And then really ended up overdoing it. But everyone who knows Werdum says that on a personal level, he's a super funny, kind of fun loving guy. And you know, I think that him making that face is just maybe an unfortunate extension of his normal personality. But at the same time, like, in the actual fight with Miocic, I don't know if Werdum took him lightly or overlooked him. Although, you know, based on some of the stuff we talked about earlier with the way that the title picture was shaping up, it seemed like Werdum, you know, it would be almost kind of understandable if he did overlook him and was looking towards a matchup with Overeem or a matchup with Velasquez or Travis Brown. But I was struck in the fight just by how relaxed and calm Stipe Miocic was. You know, he walked out chomping on this piece of chewing gum, just looking like he was out for a Sunday stroll, yeah, while there's 45,000 Brazilian fans literally chanting for his death.
Yeah.
And then he goes out there and they start the fight and he just looks super relaxed. He's gliding around the ring. He's snapping off punching combinations. And it's possible that Werdum got a little frustrated, or, you know, if frustrated isn't the right word, maybe that Werdum tried to force things a little bit, because he went into that style of offense where he was a little bit over aggressive and seemed to be just kind of flinging himself at Miocic to try to land strikes, which is, you know, you go back and look at some of his other fights, Werdum actually did that pretty successfully against Andre Arlovsky, but against Miocic, he's just able to land, you know, get Werdum to overextend himself and then land that counter right hand. So I don't exactly know what was going on with Fabricio Werdum, but as I watched it, it seemed like maybe he got a little frustrated, and maybe, you know, when Miocic looks so relaxed and composed, maybe Werdum suddenly realized once he was out there, oh, wait a second, this isn't just going to be the pushover that maybe I thought it was going to be.
Well, look, when you're in LeBron's posse, you know, yeah, your confidence level just rises like 100% if he's on your side anyway. But yeah, I mean, LeBron, Miocic, I mean, those guys are boys, you know, they got to have confidence going out there.
Yeah. And, you know, bringing the championship home to Cleveland, which I'm sure the city of Cleveland is relieved now to have the championship drought ended.
Drew Carey, Stipe Miocic, two native sons. Speaking of native sons, we share a kinship in that our home states are often ones, I think, that when you bring them up as to where you're from, you get interesting looks as if though you're from a different country, some sort of other planet, something like that. I'm originally from the great state of Maine,
and,
which a lot of people seem to think is part of Canada. I've got that quite a bit before.
I get that too. I'm from South Canada myself.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yes, that's there you go.
So Montana, as I allude to on the top, that is your state that you live in and proudly live in and have been there for quite some time. How did but Montana is not exactly known as being an MMA hotbed. How did you first kind of fall in love with the sport? And well, I guess let's start there.
I've been into MMA for a long time. I was, you know, middle school kid when a buddy of mine first came to me and he was like, my dad recorded this thing off the TV and you have to come over to my house and watch it. And we went over there and we watched a VHS cassette tape recorded off the television that in retrospect I think was UFC 2. As soon as I saw it, I was super interested in it. You know, I'd always been like a pro wrestling fan and a guy who had been kind of enamored with the idea of the early UFC of having like these all these different martial artists come together for a game of death style tournament kind of. Yeah. So I became fascinated with it at that point and had a bunch of buddies that were into it as the UFC kind of came into its own in the United States. And obviously we'd scrounge around for Pride tapes and stuff like that. I don't know, man, I'm kind of like, even when I was a kid, I've always been the kind of person that when I get into something, I get really into it. And like, you used to go to the library now, like get on the internet, but like just try to figure out everything you possibly could about whatever the thing was that you were kind of obsessed with at that time. So certainly did that about MMA for a long time. And then as you know, kind of maybe just in sheer coincidence, had a buddy from college who became a webmaster and was the webmaster for Randy Couture and Chuck Liddell and Josh Barnett and some pretty and Anderson Silva and some pretty big time fighters back in their day. And you know, I kind of started out just writing copy for their websites, and then he wanted to start a news site that reported on MMA, and we did that a little bit. And then when I got to graduate school here at the University of Montana, again, just by sheer coincidence, I happened to be in the same fiction writing group as Ben Folks, who was also an MMA and jiu-jitsu freak. And so we became friends, and then he started writing for various websites, and through my connection with him, I got hooked up with some other guys who, you know, started giving me small jobs, and over a period of time, I just kind of worked my way up the chain to the point where, you know, now I have a full-time gig working at Bleacher Report, which I feel very fortunate about. But, you know, I've always been an MMA fan, always been kind of a journalism guy and a fiction writer and a sports writer. So, you know, the time came that I was able to kind of make this my niche, and I jumped on it.
Interesting. So I was going to ask how you and Ben first met, because yeah. Ben being obviously your co-host, as you mentioned, on the co-main event podcast. And I didn't know if both of you guys had been out there writing and creating and kind of just found each other because you happen to live in the same state. So, you guys have been a creative duo for quite some time then.
Yeah, he is originally from California and came up here for graduate school, and we were in the same class. And, you know, it just so happened that, like, the first graduate school party of the year, like, I pulled up in my crappy old truck with a crappy 12-pack of crappy American beer at the exact moment that he pulled up to the party in his crappy old truck with a crappy 12-pack of crappy American beer. We both got out of our trucks at the same time and kind of looked at each other, you know, as I imagine it now, probably squinting like gunfighters. And then we went inside the party, like started drinking a couple beers, and about, you know, 45 minutes or an hour later, I found out that he was super into mixed martial arts. And it was just sort of like, okay, well, I guess this person is going to be my friend now. And we've kind of been friends ever since.
See, when you mentioned about driving up to the party and you know, now a few hours later, I just picture like a shot from the outside of the house and like someone flying through the window and you guys just cleaning house and everyone, something like that. So the story could have gone a few different directions. That's a nice way to end it.
Right. Well, you know, you're going to a graduate school English party. Most people are like drinking wine or they've got fancy liquor or something. So you pull up in front of the house with your Pabst Blue Ribbon. And there's another guy there with his Pabst Blue Ribbon. You guys look at each other and you're like, all right, this seems like a guy I can get down with.
So you, one of the things I think that the internet has certainly helped with is, especially when covering the sport, is that people don't necessarily have to be in Las Vegas. They don't have to be in California or Texas or, you know, any of these major areas where these collections of camps are and fighters and things like that, because, you know, you basically get access to the same press conferences, the same events, the same post pressers. You can interview guys, talk to them all the time, blah blah blah, all that stuff. And I would imagine that as your path has gone in covering the sport, that being in Montana, a state which doesn't have UFC coming to it regularly like some of these other hotbeds or regions, that you really, it hasn't been a, I'm guessing it hasn't been a hindrance to you, has it?
No, actually not really at all. You know, when I used to work for ESPN, and they had a pretty good travel budget and would send me around to various events. But in the litany of MMA writing jobs, that's sort of been the only time that that's ever been the case. Aside from that, I've always just covered stuff from home. And you're absolutely right in that. And the UFC has frankly been kind of forward thinking about this. I don't know if they did it consciously or just in terms of an effort to have as much content like on digital platforms as possible. They kind of have put it all online. So you don't, I mean, there's still something to be said for being there on the ground, and having that access. But at the same time, you know, you can get everything that almost everyone else has just from, you know, conference calls and press conferences and stuff like that. I don't necessarily know that that's a tremendous compliment to MMA journalism, but like you can make do with all the stuff that's online and in some cases, you know, do just as good or better of a job without actually being there. So sure, yeah, no, it's never been it's never really even been anything that someone has asked me about, like in a job interview or anything like that.
Right. And as you mentioned, you've been with a lot of great publications. People know, obviously, you know, Cage Potato, but ESPN.com, Sporting News, NBC Sports, and obviously now Bleacher Report. And
yep.
Yeah, and going along, I mean, mostly columns and things like that, but do you enjoy doing, have you been thinking about trying to do like maybe more feature type of things, more news stuff, or do you feel like as a writer, the work you're doing on the outside with writing, you know, working this novel we're going to talk about in a second, but do you find that kind of helps balance out the writing scale, so to speak, that you're not really just doing one thing, or would you like to try to do some different stuff in MMA writing?
Yeah, you know, I've been a column and opinion writer for most of my career and have done some larger features and stuff like that, which I really do enjoy doing that from time to time. I enjoyed trying to write some long form journalism stuff. And it's always just a matter of trying to fit it into, your schedule, frankly. And at this point, this last couple of years, especially while I was working on the book that is, you know, comes out in July. And then now I'm working on a second one for the same publisher. So I've had to find a balance in my life between doing MMA journalism and having time to write fiction. So I just haven't really had the chance or the time to get into like in-depth long form feature writing in a way that I think that I would have liked to. Unfortunately, my employers at Bleacher Report have been understanding about that and have been supportive of me being a column and opinion writer. And I hope that someday life slows down a little bit. You know, I have two small children. I have a 3-year-old daughter and a 10-month-old son, you know, and what should amount to two kind of full-time jobs. So at some point, hopefully, it will slow down a little bit and I will have time to stretch my legs and get into some more of that, you know, in-depth feature reporting and writing like I kind of want to do. But right now I just have to strike that balance.
Well, one of the weights on the scales for balancing is this book that's coming out. I'd say hotly anticipated is probably one way to describe it. I've been hearing a lot about this, via the Twitter for months and months and months and months by people that know what they're talking about. It's called Champion of the World. Comes out in July, as you mentioned, and greater booksellers everywhere. And for our audience, which is, you know, we talk about MMA a lot on this show, but obviously our website, WrestlingObserver.com, primarily professional wrestling. And this is what this book is about. There's a nice write-up and kind of description on Amazon, but I guess for the wrestling fans that are listening to this, give the elevator pitch, why they want to hear it, what's the book about, and what's the inspiration for it?
Yeah, it's like you said, called Champion of the World. It's a historical novel that takes place in the early 1920s, and it's kind of about the transition of professional wrestling from hard-nosed, legitimate sport as it was, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s into the choreographed spectacle that we know today. And so it centers on some lifelong professional wrestlers and these guys that have spent their entire lives trying to make sure that they're the toughest guys around and now trying to reconcile with a new world where that doesn't necessarily matter anymore. And you know, that it takes place during Prohibition as well, so that there's some plot lines about bootlegging and card sharking and carnivals. And I feel pretty strongly that people out there who are professional wrestling fans or have an interest in the history of combat sports or the history of wrestling will be drawn into it and be entertained by it.
So you you mentioned earlier you're a you grew up a professional wrestling fan. And
sure did.
Is it something that you still stay in touch with at all, or are you more kind of an older footage type of, you know, kind of the old days, so to speak, guy?
No, I try to stay in touch with wrestling as much as I can. I don't, again, have time to like watch Raw every week or anything like that.
You're not missing anything.
Well, I mean, now that you got the 3-hour show, man, it's kind of tough to find that window of time when you can block that out and sit down and watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I try to keep tabs on like what's happening over there. I read a lot of you know, wrestling writers and reporting about what's happening in WWE. I really like Lucha Underground when that came out last year or the year before. I really got into that. I've fallen behind a little bit in watching season 2 of Lucha Underground again, just because of time constraints. But like, while I'm not as fascinated by the, you know, by wholeheartedly fascinated by the spectacle of professional wrestling like I was when I was a kid, like, you know, and I'm sure the listening audience and Josh, maybe you too, probably identify this with this, but like as an adult, I still find it fascinating, but maybe in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The business side of it. And that's one of the most interesting parts is to understand this, this major company, and in smaller ones to an extent, but why they do what they do and you know, the fan reaction to certain things and what drives this. And really, especially in this, this new digital era, content era that we're in, how that is driving success as opposed to, you know, quality of product, which is such a weird thing in entertainment, because as you mentioned, 3 hours, I think, you know, Breaking Bad was great because it was 1 hour a week and it would go away for a while and then it would come back and just build anticipation.
Right.
You know, shows like Raw, it's tough because it's competing against so many other things when it comes to our entertainment eyes and minds and all that. And it's tough. It's tough to engage with, especially when the product doesn't feel like it's really kind of scratching that itch, you know? And so it's difficult in the, who do you're trying to appeal to and how do you try to appeal to all audiences while trying to build up the younger audience that you hope is going to stay with you for 10 plus years? The business side often is sometimes more fascinating than the in-ring stuff, which is, I'm sure some people cringe, but that's just kind of the way it is.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I think you just mentioned it, but one of the interesting things about the WWE product right now is like, at a micro step-by-step level, I feel like it seems like they're doing a lot of things right. You know, they have kind of an embarrassment of riches in terms of talent right now, and opening the door a little bit to some more of these established indie stars and some of the NXT stars, so that, you know, having guys like Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn and Cesaro, it feels like the right move. It feels like the proper direction to in some ways turn the company over to the younger stars and let them try to run with it, which I think for years was what critical professional wrestling fans were probably calling for. And in a, like kind of a minute step-by-step way, it feels like that is happening, which I'm in favor of, but like in a macro way, in an umbrella way, the WWE product feels so much like it is the product of an enormous international corporation that's beholden to shareholders and written by committee, that it almost feels like wrestling is not really the product, right? It feels like Raw is a 3-hour commercial for Subway or for, you know, for Arby's or whoever is the main title sponsor these days. And that to me, like, makes it really hard to get into in a sustained way. And like, I'm a writer, so I always bring it back to like, you know, it feels like WWE is doing a lot of things right, but the writing, the line by line writing is still so kind of bad that it's oftentimes hard to commit 3 hours to sit down and try to watch it, which is one of the things that I thought was wonderful about Lucha Underground when it came out, was like, not only did it imagine this world completely removed from the quote unquote WWE universe, but like, it also just had continuity of writing. It made sense from week to week. You know, two guys who had been the bitter enemies were not suddenly going to be friends like 3 weeks later, just because that's what had to happen to fill the live 3 hour show or whatever. And like that to me was a really appealing thing, to sort of have a wrestling show that, number one, felt like a wrestling show, even though Lucha Underground is obviously way over the top in terms of theatrics.
Yeah.
Like, number two, was an hour long. So it, like you said, it had that sort of like appeal of not having to commit too much time, and you could watch it like a weekly hour long show. And number three, like, just kind of was well done from a production standpoint, and like made sense from week to week. And that to me just like made it such a revelation when I first saw it.
Something we hear a lot from our audience as well, as they really, really enjoy it. But the book, before I forget about the book, how did the inspiration come for the book? I'm always interested in process and then execution, from the concept to actually getting someone to publish. So, when did this idea first begin, and then how did you find the avenue to make it happen?
Yeah. So the old cliche in writing circles is that you want to write the book that you would like to read. Like, if you saw the book at the bookstore, you would pick it up and go buy it, take it home and read it. You want to write that book. So Champion of the World was kind of like this synergy of two of my lifelong loves, right? Like, I've always been a professional wrestling guy. I've always aspired to write fiction. And so they just kind of came together to make this book. And one of the things that happened was that I was kind of looking around at the fiction world, and I was trying to figure out, why are there no books about wrestling? Like, why is there no, I don't know if serious is the right word, because I hesitate to apply that to myself, but like, Right. Why is there no like serious adult literature about wrestling when there is a ton of serious adult literature about boxing, you know, from like Fat City to The Professional, whatever. There's boxers everywhere in American literature. American literature is lousy with boxers. But there's no wrestlers. There's no wrestling book. And in maybe like a grandiose kind of way, I was like, you know what? I'm going to write one. And maybe my unattainable goal is to write the great American wrestling novel, because I didn't know if there was one out there. So maybe that's what I set out to do. And again, that's like kind of a grandiose way to say it. But at the same time, man, you sit down to write a historical fiction novel about professional wrestling, the last thing that you think is like, oh, this is going to be huge. You know, like, you try not to think about it, frankly, and you just pray at some point that you get somebody to read it. And in my case, I was super fortunate. I actually I published a short story in a noir fiction magazine called Thug Lit, which is a wonderful magazine. I heard it's going to be ending soon, which I'm kind of disappointed about. But the longtime editor there, Todd Robinson, is also a professional wrestling fan. And I had this like professional wrestling crime story that I had written that I had tried to get published in some larger literary magazines, and it had been rejected. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to send it to Thug Lit. This guy likes wrestling. He might be into it. So I sent it to them, and they graciously published it. And then after it came out in their magazine, the guy who ultimately became my agent contacted me and asked me if I had a novel underway. And I was able to say, why, yes, I do. I do. I have a novel about professional wrestling. So I sent him an early draft of it. He liked it. We worked together on it for, a couple of years to get into shape where he thought that we could send it out to editors and publishing companies. So we did that, and we're fortunate enough to find a publishing company that wanted to publish it. So it comes out in about 2 months.
What did you learn about the process of trying to sell a book?
I'm still learning. It's a strange business, especially for a person who's involved in journalism, because I'm involved in this industry that moves very quickly. And the publishing industry is the exact opposite of that. It's still a very old school industry, an industry that where everything takes a little bit of time. They're ultimately going to put out a great product that they want people to, you know, spend $25 on. But it definitely moves at a speed that is different than like the digital now journalism industry,
right,
that I'm used to. So in journalism, especially if you're writing, you know, about MMA or like in the digital world, if you send somebody an email and they don't email you back within a couple hours, you start being like, oh, did I make that person mad? Like, was it something that I said? Like, publishing is the exact opposite. You email people, they might email you like a week later. Yeah. So just adjusting to the flow of the industry was one thing. And, I'm still kind of learning as I go, just in terms of knowing how to make the right move from day to day.
So, and you said you already have a second book in the works. Is this something you have, you mentioned this one took you a few years to do. Is this kind of the starting process for the second book? Are you at now? Are you into writing or is it wrestling related or a different subject? What can you reveal for us?
It's not wrestling related. It's a contemporary thriller about an Iraq war veteran who comes back to his hometown in Montana, having suffered what he believes to be a traumatic brain injury and has lost his autobiographical memory. So he doesn't really remember anything about his own life. And once he gets back to his hometown, he and his high school longtime girlfriend witness a mysterious house fire, which then kind of sucks the both of them into this mystery that they have to kind of unravel. So it's about this young guy who's a vet, like not only trying to figure out this mystery, but also trying to figure out kind of the mystery of his own life. And I sold it to the publishing company at the same time that I sold Champion of the World, which it was in late 2014. And like I said, that the industry progresses at its own pace. And so by the time I signed my contract to publish Champion of the World, the publishing company had already filled up its 2015 schedule. So Champion of the World didn't end up coming out until July 2016. And so I've been working on the second novel since then. And I have to turn it in to the publishing company in the fall of this year. So I'm pretty well into it. I've got I'm through a couple of different drafts. I've got a working draft that I continue to type away on every day, and we'll have it ready for them by the fall.
So you're thinking Matt Damon for the film adaption?
You betcha, man. Whoever wants to write the seven-figure check can do whoever they want.
But seriously, I mean, these days when it comes to, you know, I imagine every movie studio must have interns just pouring through every book they can get their hands on at the library, anything at that, just to try to get rights. It's crazy. I mean, has it crossed your mind that one of these novels that you're creating now and possibly in the future could turn into something that you see on the big screen? I mean, that must be a trip thinking about that.
Yeah, it crosses my mind all the time. It's just kind of one ticket in the lottery after another when you try to get involved in the publishing industry, because, you know, first you have to find an agent who will read your book, and then you have to find a book editor who will read your book and buy it, and all of that stuff, you know, feels like one hurdle after another, one slightly larger hurdle after another. And then, the biggest hurdle of them all, I guess you could say, the golden goose in the entire equation is you sell the film or TV rights to someone. Knock on wood, I hope to be lucky enough at some point during my writing career to see that happen to one of my books. I agree with you that it would be a totally strange and hopefully wonderful experience. But it's the kind of thing that you try not to think about too often, because there's no telling if and when or ever that it will happen. But it does creep into your mind, because there's big bucks floating around in Hollywood, and it would be super weird to see that to see something that you created then eventually show up on the big screen or the small screen, frankly, for that matter.
Well, hopefully when that day comes, you'll remember all the little people like us along the way on the ladder success. Before I let you go, I want to give you a chance to, we didn't really talk about the co-main event podcast, but to plug, obviously, social media, where you'd like people to buy the book, and also the co-main event podcast for those people that haven't heard it.
Yeah, you can pre-order the book right now. You can do that at Amazon or, you know, Indiegogo or BarnesandNoble.com or Powell's.com, anywhere books are sold. And it comes out on July 12th in the hardcover. So you can go out to your local bookstore and buy it then, or you can pick it up on your Kindle or your Nook, your e-reader, whatever you want. The co-main event podcast comes out every week, comes out Monday afternoons. Usually it's about an hour long. And it's frankly just Ben Folks and I shooting the breeze about mixed martial arts. Once a week, we try to keep it unscripted. We try to keep it irreverent. We try to take on the big issues of the day, but we try to do it in a hopefully kind of an intelligent but also entertaining way. We don't always hit the mark on both, but we give it our best shot. You can find that at comainevent.com or find us on iTunes, or we are also on Google Play now, and we are on Stitcher. So the Co-Main Event podcast, you can search for that anywhere. You can follow me on Twitter at Chad Dundas. Last name is Dundas. That's about it. That kind of made me feel like old school Zack Ryder there. Just telling people everywhere they can find me.
I like it. You're the MMA equivalent of Zack Ryder.
For better and worse, I guess.
Exactly. Well, he's got great hair, man. He's got great hair. So
wish I had that hair.
Same here. This has been a lot of fun. Chad Dundas, thanks so much for joining Josh Nason's Punch Out this week.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Josh.
All right, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that. Big thanks to Chad Dundas for spending almost an hour with me on Wednesday afternoon. Go pick up his book, especially if you're into pro wrestling, you're into novels. Nice little marriage there for you. I think you'll like it. Looking forward to reading it myself coming out this summer. And also check out his work on the Co-Main Event podcast as well as BleacherReport.com. And also let him know that you heard him here on the show. That helps me out too. So let's see. Other news coming up about a night ago, we have some new fights coming up. UFC 201, I'm underwhelmed, but that's to be expected given that, you know, all these cards leading up to UFC 200 and UFC 200 itself are just so great. So they have to save a little bit considering they have for some reason, I don't know why they're having UFC 201 that same month coming up in July 30th from Atlanta, Georgia, Robbie Lawler versus Tyron Woodley. The Woodley thing doesn't do anything for me. Basically, he's been on the shelf for a year and a half. To me, wasn't that exciting before he got hurt, and now it's kind of the same thing. So I'm just really not that. There's just no real interest in seeing him fight. I mean, hopefully this could be a good fight. Robbie Lawler always seems to put on good fights, especially in the last couple of years. But this one really doesn't do that much for me. Neither does the co-main event, Demetrius Johnson fighting. I feel like I've talked about this ad nauseum. I don't know. I feel people in the media, and I'm noticing this more and more, I just feel like are kind of going overboard and trying to shame people that don't care about watching them fight. And I'm kind of getting a little annoyed by it. So I'm going to try to, you know, even my temper, not get too upset about it. It's just a guy fighting, and he's a great guy. I've interviewed him a long time ago for a different show that I did for a radio station. No doubt his accomplishments are fantastic. Just I think when people are trying to tell you that this is that he's worth the price of admission, and it just I don't know. I feel like I'm really adverse to hard sells, and I think with the whole Johnson thing and the whole flyweight division, I feel like I'm being hard sold something here, and that's why I'm kind of chafing against it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just not into it. But regardless, that's a co-main event. Wilson Hayes is his opponent for that. Enough said about that. And I'm interested to see what happens with this Chris Cyborg thing. As you may have heard, they announced that they were working on this fight, Chris Cyborg versus Jermaine Durandamy at 140-pound catchweight. What I think is interesting about this, regardless if the fight happens or not, is after Cyborg won, I don't think it really matters. You know, some people were talking about, you know, she doesn't have a weight class, and how are they going to book her again? I honestly don't think they care, and I don't think we should either. They're going to put her out there to fight two or three times a year, and that's really all that matters to them. Is just they want to create a star that people are going to pay to watch as part of it, much bigger pay-per-view, co-main event, or perhaps some sort of third from the top like they're trying to do with this show. Who knows? I think it's kind of dumb of her to prefer the I'm going to defend my title on an Invicta show as opposed to a UFC pay-per-view. I think that's just she's getting some bad advice, or just I'm not really sure what the thought process is there. Anyway, I think we haven't seen the last of Cyborg Santos in the UFC, but it doesn't matter if she has a division or not, and that's the interesting thing. To me, it makes sense if they do a 145-pound division, just have her fight there. Saw today that Holly Holm said she'll fight her at 140 pounds. So there seems to be an interest in having her cut weight to some extent, but not go all the way to 135 and almost not let her get away with, quote-unquote, having her fight at 145. It's just a very interesting situation. It's an exhausting situation that people have talked about ad nauseum. But I think the UFC just cares about having a draw. And if this whole sale thing happens, we'll see. The rules could change for how we view everything. And that's going to be a very interesting watch here in the next couple months ahead. And, obviously these other fights, UFC Fight Night South Dakota, Michael Chiesa versus Tony Ferguson. Obviously, Michael Chiesa, past guest on this show. That fight is going to be awesome. But the co-main event that they announced, Michael McDonald versus John Lineker, that should be great as well. And, yeah, that's basically all the big stuff that was announced. And we have another crazy few months ahead. And it's always fun when there's stakes when it comes to these UFC cards, when you feel like there's stuff loaded up, people that we know. UFC has had a fantastic 2016. There is no doubt about it. And I think injury-wise and all that stuff, hopefully everyone is relatively good. This Chris Weidman thing has got me wondering if he's even going to be ready for November, and hopefully he doesn't push himself to the point of hurting himself later in life. But, those are their decisions to make and the doctor's decisions to make. But injury-wise, if everyone stays good, we're going to have a pretty killer second half of the year as well. And hopefully in the weeks ahead on this show, we'll talk a little bit about some potential new title fights and talk about, who would we like to see fight who, and a lot of interesting opportunities to do some I want to say fantasy matchmaking, but kind of look at where the roadmap is and whether we like it or don't like it. And the way that's looking, we have some fun title fights and some fun secondary contenders ahead. So I think we got to get through this stretch and see where we're at the end of UFC 200. And I think kind of it's WrestleMania season, so to speak, hit the reset button after that and kind of see where we sit with all the major players. And of course, where's Conor McGregor going to fight? Is Ronda Rousey ever going to come back? All these questions. So there's so many other stars that we have to see fight for the rest of the year. And I think UFC 200 is going to have us jaws agape as these events always do, with the amount of news and everything coming out of that. And we'll be talking about it right here. So with all that out of the way, I'm going to let you guys go. Have an awesome weekend. And thank you for listening. Feel free to share this around liberally. I always appreciate that as well. Big thanks to Chad Dundas. Thanks to all of you. And until next time, insert catchphrase here.